Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And yes, indeed, The Sun and Moon today. A great book by Joe Pappalardo on the secret history of sunflowers.
It's a cosmic show we've got here,
actually. It is a cosmic show. But very interesting perspective on the archaic period and the cultivation of sunflowers, the domestication, all the way to sunflowers going to the moon. That's full circle for you.
And we just don't think of the big picture enough, the symbiotic relationships between man and nature, and in this case, sunflowers, and found in North America, over to Europe, back to America, maybe played a part in Hitler invading Russia in World War II, maybe the Irish potato famine, just a monster story condensed in a really interesting book.
Yeah, it's a good read for sure. We enjoyed it. So we'll be talking to him in the second part of the show. And then also The Evening Garden, the opposite side of the sun.
The fragrant.
Peter Lower, pretty well known for knowing a lot about evening plants. He's in Asheville, North Carolina. So we're going to talk about those, you know, why in fact, but those plants that start to open their blooms once the sun goes down. And I know that he was inspired to get involved in night blooming plants because of just being so darn busy during the day. So it's a good story, and we look forward to talking to him.
He's a funny, sardonic, and interesting man.
Yeah, he is. So, Bob, what's going on in your garden these days?
It's filling in. Yeah. You know, we talk a lot about weeding, and I spent years weeding some of my garden beds. But finally, after 3 or 4 years, some of my perennial borders and grasses and things are filling in nicely. My weeding is almost nil, just up around the edges.
Yeah.
So it's something I think when you plant a garden, you think it's never going to do what you want it to do. 3 or 4 years it will, and then the fifth year you start dividing.
Well, and you've got to be diligent. It's not just the crowdedness of all the good stuff that you want, but you have to be diligent about weeding for years so that you kind of eliminate the parentage of the rest of the stuff.
But actually, we've got 8 acres of stuff and less weeding than ever this year.
Uh-huh.
Other thing is, the mock orange this year was fantastic.
Was it? Everything
beautiful,
was really
bright,
nice this year.
Fragrant white flowers. How about the Wishy Estate? What's up?
Well, I'm sure you've heard the news, and Jody Ellis has always been so good with keeping us up to date on the Emerald Ash Borer, but officially in the state of Kentucky, Bob, and guess where it is?
Shelby County.
Shelby County, the county that I live in.
Yep.
I really didn't think that I was going to have to deal with this so soon.
Well,
I mean, it's been in Indiana for a while.
Well, a year or two, but across the river.
And they're saying they believe that it's been in the one place where it's been identified for at least several years because of the advancement of the damage. So I did. I followed Jody's advice. I went and I bought some Bayer soak, 1.47% people, imidacloprid. You can treat it yourself if the trunk circumference is under 45 inches.
Is it expensive?
It was not that expensive. It was like $15 for Bayer soak to save a tree. If your tree's bigger than 45 inches in circumference, then you have to have a professional do it, and then it gets expensive, but you know that may level out.
We can put on our website the name of that chemical, I think, can be a good idea.
Imidacloprid, there's information out of Purdue that you know, but the bottom line is 1.47%. Make sure that's the active ingredient, and you can treat it yourself. Ideally in April, she said, so we're kind of running out of time, but you know, follow up every year and treat your small ash trees as a preventative measure.
Absolutely. I'm going to do it too.
Yeah.
It's my shade for my porch.
Well, you're running out of time, babe, so you know, get it done.
I will.
Yeah.
Speaking of things to do, there's a lot going on in this area. Udell Gardens begins its 2009 concert series on the third Thursday of every month, beginning on June 18th with the Harry Pickens Trio.
All right, sounds good.
Also, the Jeffersonville Main Street Garden Tour is Saturday, June 20th, rain or shine. You can get your tickets at Preservation Park in downtown Jeff, see some of the finest gardens in Jeffersonville.
Excellent.
And one of my favorite places in Utica, Indiana, Hidden Hill Nursery and Sculpture Garden, is having the Louisville Dulcimer Society June 20th.
That sounds cool.
Slow Food with Mark Williams.
Of course.
Huber Wine Tasting.
Of course.
And the University of Louisville Art Department is going to put some fairies on my Ferris wheel and make it a
Ferris
wheel.
Yep. That'll be good.
All on the website.
On the website. Yeah, WFPL.org. The Audubon Park Garden Club presents their 8th annual garden tour also on Saturday, June 20th from 10 to 4. You can get your tickets and maps at the Audubon Park City Hall there on Robin Road in the neighborhood. And then the Louisville Nature Center, they've got a bunch of different half-day and full-day, you know, summer camps going on. So really you'll want to check out their website for all the details. But they've got Exploring Kentucky Wildlife Camp from 9 to 4 p.m. starting June 22nd, Bob, and then another round starting July 13th. So there's different opportunities to get involved in some cool summer camps there at the Louisville Nature Center. But yeah, again, check out our website at WFPL.org for all the details on the events.
Well, there's also some great things going on at night.
There are some great things going on at night. The allure of night.
Yes.
And blooms and fragrance in the evening garden. Peter Lower has been following the light of the moon and the blooms of evening for decades now, and he makes a great observation. It may be the best time for some of us with a busy schedule to finally enjoy the garden. Peter Lower is the author of The Evening Garden, Flowers and Fragrance from Dusk Till Dawn. As a gardener, writer, and illustrator of blooms that appear after dusk, Peter's grown and drawn nearly all of them. There are about 160 of them in his book alone, so I suspect he knows a little bit about blooming flowers. Peter, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be there.
Great. How did your fascination begin with nocturnal plants?
Oh, well, you know, it came from, believe it or not, beginning to garden while running a studio in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, that old story.
Yeah.
And the end result was that you were busy selling yourself and running the studio and everything all the time.
Uh-huh.
And at one point, I got some dirt from Central Park. Because back then, you didn't go into, you know, stores and buy bags of soil. And I thought, I told my wife, you know, if John Cheever can do it, we can do
yeah.
it and have something to, an excuse to have a cocktail.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
So we started with Night Blooming Cereus,
uh-huh.
which, of course, immediately half the people on the block were there.
Yeah.
And then we graduated to Moonflowers.
Uh-huh.
Because you can grow those in a pot anywhere.
Right.
That's true.
And then Gene and I did a book, which mm-hmm. actually won the Bank Street Book Award back in 1997 for the Moonflower, and it's still in print.
Excellent. So, busy during the day, wanting to enjoy a cocktail at night with the neighbors, you have to have evening and night blooming plants, right?
Absolutely. I mean, okay. you have to have something to raise a glass of Bock Chardonnay to.
Yeah.
Is there a general profile in night bloomers, particular zones? Or?
Well, yeah, most of the really good night bloomers for gardening purposes are generally tropical plants,
mm-hmm.
and they grow wonderfully in tubs. Because, you know, if you ever go to the jungles, you'll find that the soil 2 inches down is just rock.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these jungle plants, orchids, many of them are epiphytic.
Mm-hmm.
So they do very, very well in pots. And that way, when they're out of bloom, you can kind of shovel the pot over to the end of the terrace or the garden and bring in another one.
Well, and I've read and heard different things about the poisonous proclivities of some of these plants. Are they indeed poisonous, or do you have to eat 50 pounds before it really matters?
Well, no, there are a couple of them that are. And Brooksmansia, you know, you go into any nursery now, and they have those peach-colored dangling bells
mm-hmm.
that are very fragrant.
Yeah.
Well, you know what they're the source of?
No, sir.
Scopolamine.
What's scopolamine?
That's the truth serum.
Yeah.
Oh.
And whenever you saw movies in the Second World War
uh-huh.
where, you know, the Nazi doctor was trying to get a confession out of the poor airman that had crashed
right.
outside of Berlin.
yeah.
And they'd come in, you know, with those little wired-rimmed glasses, which are so popular today. And they'd have a hypodermic needle, and they'd shoot it up to the sky just to make sure that there was no air in the needle. I never understood that, because they're going to kill these people anyway. And then they would inject you, and you'd count back from 99. And by the time you got to 94, they would say, when will the next air raid occur? And you'd answer in slow motion, 2 o'clock tomorrow night.
But if you ate the plant instead of being injected by it, would you still be telling the truth to people? Or
no. What happens then is you have very, very bad stomach problems, okay. And some people will survive. Mm-hmm. But every year, the one that's really bad is Datura, which is the annual form.
Okay. Right.
And many of the Amerindians used it as a hallucinogenian, mm-hmm. and also they would have all kinds of rituals built around the flowers because they're so absolutely beautiful.
Uh-huh. Is that the is the seed pod prickly on that one?
Yes.
Okay, because I think that grows out in our prairie.
Yes. But yeah. The flower, you know, it's just, mm-hmm. just beautiful, and
beautiful
it smells
way.
So sweet.
Mm-hmm.
But every year you'll see some kids down generally in Miami mm-hmm. will find a seed pod and they'll chew some of the black seeds.
Wow.
And you chew enough of them and that's it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so back to the whole like tropical thing, and you were just they grow well in tubs, you were describing, because the shallow soil, et cetera. Is there a response to the environment as well in terms of it blooming in the evening or at night that also corresponds with the culture of the tropical forest?
No, and you know the wonderful story about whole empires collapsing is the poinsettia.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to make the poinsettia bloom, it must have, I think it's about 20, but it could be 24 hours for a week mm-hmm. of no light at night.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you've heard people who've lost fortunes because they forgot to shade the greenhouse or somebody walked in and turned a light on.
Right.
Well, these plants are very specific. They're not going to be forced into blooming in noon, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can't fool them by putting them in a dark room. They want to be out, and just like clockwork, many of them, like the evening primroses, open their flowers like a Disney nature film,
mm-hmm.
you know, just very slowly. And the wonderful thing about growing evening primroses, the biennial form in the garden, is that you attract hawk moths.
Hmm.
And kids, not only adults, but kids go crazy over hawk moths mm-hmm. because they're like hairier jets.
Is that the sphinx moth as
yes.
well? Okay.
And
which
they come
the
flying
worm, right?
in from all over, and they are so sensitive to you being there. They never run into you or fly into you, but they go directly for those flowers.
Hmm.
And, of course, the next day they look like worn-out bells of the ball. I mean, they just kind of shrivel up.
So is that the whole point, then, blooming at a certain time in the evening, is that they want those certain moths or insects or whatever it may be that come out at that time, just like an evolutionary process?
It's an evolutionary deal where there were so many plants that were vying for daytime pollinators that a whole deal opened up with flowers at night. And now sit back for this one. I this is amazing. There are, in most of the United States at any given time, about 700 species of butterfly. But there are over 1,400 moths.
Wow.
Okay.
And we live in the Appalachians here, and they're continually, every year, they'll find a new moth species. And so you can go out here at night, and the crowd of moths that come to some of these plants, most of them are small and inconspicuous, but then you'll get some of the silk moths and the luna moths. They're amazingly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Is the moon a player in this game at all?
No. Well, it is. There's one particular pitcher plant. And a friend of mine, Larry Mellencamp, who runs the gardens over in Charlotte for the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, knew I was into a lot of this stuff. And at one point he asked me why some of his pitcher plants were dying. And he said they were full of moths. And, of course, it turned out that he had some of these pitcher plants that are particularly adapted to glow under moonlight because there are white specks at the top of the pitcher.
Wow.
Huh.
And he had it next to the parking lot.
Oh, no.
And the parking lot lights were on all night.
Yeah.
Right.
So if they had been regular pitcher plants, they probably could have survived. But these had smaller pitchers, and they couldn't take, you know, night after night after night of moths flying into them.
How about temperatures? Are they a factor in opening and closing and so forth?
Well, you know, I can't say yes or no, but I assume yes, because... Yeah. All of the night-blooming plants that are native to North America, they all bloom, you know, from May and June when things warm up.
Mm-hmm.
And the tropicals, I'm pretty sure it's the same.
Well, let's talk some specific plants that people might try and that you have in your garden that do very well with maybe minimal work.
Well, one of the marvels, and even the box stores carry these now, are the water lilies.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And you just get the tropical water lilies, and they bloom at night.
Huh.
I didn't know that.
And they're so good at it. I mean, you know, people have picked them for bouquets for dinner parties.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's been a dastardly mistake because, of course, the minute the sun comes up the next morning, they all clamp shut.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you grow those in a container next to your patio?
Yeah, you could throw them in a wash bucket, something like that.
So many people have water features now, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not difficult. You know, if you got a couple of teenagers to come in and dig the hole, you can wind up with using some of these pond liners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can do a beautiful garden pond over a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be darned. What are some other plants, then, for the average
yard?
Well,
the moonflower, because any place I go now, I see that they have seed for sale for the moonflower.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And all you have to remember about the moonflower is to nick the seed. The instructions are on the package, but you nick the seed. And they, like caladiums and a lot of these other tropicals, will not do well when the soil is under 65 degrees.
So wait until it warms up.
So you have to wait until it warms up.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of people don't realize that the plant that you grow for all the penguin gourds and all of those things,
mm-hmm.
that's a night bloomer too.
What is it?
And I'm trying desperately to think of a name. You know, it's that bottle gourd and the penguin gourd,
mm-hmm.
and all of those plants are night bloomers.
Mm-hmm.
And the flowers are absolutely beautiful, but of course you can't pick them because they're like tissue paper, and they're gone the next day.
But most of these plants are rather prolific in producing bloom every evening. Is that not true?
Did you ever see at the nursery one of these Brugsmansias that has been fertilized well?
Mm-hmm.
They'll have on a plant about 6 feet high. At any given time, there'll be 25 or 30 blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll keep at it all summer long. And you've got to remember, too, that when people ask me about fertilizing, I don't generally recommend a lot of fertilizing because if you, for example, are in Asheville and you look out the window, you're surrounded by mountains of trees, and no one's fertilized them since the dinosaurs walked.
Right.
And they fertilize themselves with their own leaves. But when you grow tropical plants and bedding plants and geraniums and everything else in pots, the water from continually watering kind of leaches out the good stuff in the soil.
Uh-huh.
So I always tell people if they're growing night-blooming plants or any plants for blossoms in pots, to fertilize at least every 3 weeks, you know, with just a regular...
Mm-hmm.
thing that you mix the crystals in the water with.
Sure.
Would Osmocote work, a slow release kind of thing?
I don't think that really won't work as well because those slow release things sometimes take up to 6 months.
Okay, yeah.
And by that time, you're under 6 feet of snow.
Right. So I want to tell you a story about my night blooming cereus. It's in my office, which is windows, you know, at home.
Yeah.
Windows. And I usually don't have a light on there at night anyway, right? So it has its good day and night natural light. And it's got a big bud ready to open. But the downside to it, as you expressed in the very beginning, is that these things open, you know, at midnight or later. So you often miss it. So we were in Spain 1 year, And it was a dreadful time getting home after many airplane flights and such. And we finally managed to get home about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
You walk into the house and you smell this smell.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh my goodness, what is that? And we walk in there and that thing is covered in fully open bloom. So the payoff of the dreadful flights coming home, you know, taking, you know, 2 days to finally get home, was that we got to come home to this night blooming cereus that was in full bloom at 4 o'clock in the morning.
No, they're truly, I mean, my wife, when she saw the first one, she said, my God, it's the first flower I've seen that looks like it deserves a funeral. Because
mm-hmm.
it's so incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's another plant that a lot of people grow, and they never realize, and that's the yucca.
That it blooms at night, too.
And that blooms at night. And what if you go out and look at a yucca stalk with all those blossoms, in the daytime, they're all droopy and kind of flaccid.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go out at night, the sap starts to pump the blossoms up, and mm-hmm. they exude a very sweet, it's almost like toilet soap perfume.
Mm-hmm.
And they attract this little quarter-inch moth called a yucca moth. And they're well worth any investment of time. And, of course, as a plant, they're great because they're all there, you know, all year long.
Mm-hmm.
And the other plant that you really have to pay attention to is the night-blooming daylily.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Discovered back at the end of the 1800s by a couple of Jesuit botanists in China.
Mm-hmm.
And they were brought back to the United States, and the daylily people went nuts. They thought they could produce a two-day lily.
Uh-huh.
By taking genes from the night bloomer.
Oh, yeah.
It's never worked in 100 years. But what has happened is that a number of the genes have gotten so mixed up that you can now have some daylilies which exhibit night blooming behavior, but they're not the original night bloomer.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. What are some cultivars of night blooming daylilies you might look for?
Here's a couple. Alice Gibson. Eeny, weeny. you know, some of these names are embarrassing.
I guess.
Green dragonfly.
Mm-hmm.
Jewel of hearts. Lemon mint. And Paul Bunyan. And there are dozens of them.
Now, what is the best light to enjoy a night-blooming plant? I mean, assume a flashlight would be no fun. Do you ever have a low radiation light?
Well, you know, a lot of these open up as the sky above goes into that deep purple,
right,
and the stars start to come out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have garden lights, you know, strung Japanese lanterns,
okay, like
candles on the table,
that's the best.
They're not going to bother any of the plants. They're going to continue to open.
And you'll be able to enjoy them under the right light conditions.
Absolutely.
As well. Yeah.
So you sit out there on a bench and you're surrounded by this fragrance and color, and why do you go back in the house?
It's truly.
To get more wine.
No kidding. The smell of some night blooming jasmine
mm-hmm.
is incredibly pungent,
huh.
And that's why it used to be so popular as a perfume of the ladies of the night. And I'm not making that up.
No,
I mean,
makes sense.
You know, jasmine has always been this incredible scent that you walk into a garden with one shaft of jasmine, and you can smell it from 30 feet away.
Interesting.
Okay, then come the hard frost of fall. What do you do for the plants? How do you take them indoors or take care of them?
Well, I have a greenhouse, which it's getting harder and harder to get into. And full of this stuff. And all of the Brooks Manzias and things like that, you just withhold water. You don't let them dry out completely, but you just withhold water, and they go into a kind of hiatus. And you, as long as they're above 40 degrees, most jungle plants will do well. And they just sit there and wait for spring and then burst forth again.
Mm-hmm.
Do you whack them back quite a bit before you set them out again?
Yeah, I generally hack them back to produce new growth, and so they get bushier.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate
Indeed.
It.
Oh, you're very, very welcome.
All right. Peter Lower is the author of The Evening Garden, published by Timber Press. When not gardening, writing, or illustrating, Peter teaches botanical art. He spoke to us from his home in Asheville, North Carolina. For more information on Night Bloomers and Peter's other books, please visit our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, Joe Papalardo uncovers the secret history of sunflowers. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishing.
Looking for a sunny time, no doubt.
We are. And we came across this fabulous book, Sunflowers, The Secret History. And it's the kind of book that we love because it exemplifies the importance of plants in human history, socially, politically, economically, food-wise, civilization.
Yeah.
And the corn always gets like... corn is king,
right?
And the sunflower history is secret, but not anymore.
Oh, we got a guy to tell us all about it. Joe Papalardo is a reporter and writer for Popular Mechanics, a former associate editor of Smithsonian's Air and Space magazine, and has written for publications as diverse as Time Magazine and The Village Voice. He's with us today to talk about his latest book, Sunflowers, The Secret History. Joe, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Definitely appreciate it.
Well, I love your background. It's, you know, a mix of Popular Mechanics and Smithsonian Air and Space magazine, but where did the interest in sunflowers come from?
It's funny. You wouldn't think that my journalistic background would apply very seamlessly to a book on flowers, but as it turns out, the sunflower is a very, very interesting subject of a lot of scientific study in terms of where it came from, how it's used, and there's anthropology, science, space experiments come into it, and there's also a lot of military history, and it's a multidisciplinary sort of an approach to describing the uses of this plant.
Was there any point in time, Joe, that it was like, ha-ha, the sunflower.
I got to write a book about this.
That's the story that is going to allow me to incorporate all of these different interesting things and really uncover something.
Yes, there was the eureka moment came for me when I started looking at there was a rash of sort of commodity books, and I was reading The Prize by which is the history of oil by
right.
Daniel Yergin,
right.
Which won a Pulitzer Prize, and I thought, oh, you know, it's the history of a commodity, and there's got to be a lot of interest in anything that's you know, traded publicly. So I went to the Chicago's Commodity Exchange and looked around, and sunflowers caught my eye, both seed and oil.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking at it. It has this natural narrative arc of where the sunflower came from, where it went, and then how it came back again. And it started in North America, went to Europe, changed entirely into an oil seed crop in Russia, and then came back to North America via Canada and really transformed a lot of agriculture in the Red River Valley and really all over the Midwest. And so it was sort of that natural, it had a story to tell, a long epic story.
Joe, let's talk a little bit about the sunflower itself. What genetically makes it so unique and durable and so important to man for literally thousands of years?
It really literally is a, you know, born to be domesticated. The plant itself is very hardy. It's very like an iceberg. Most of, and like a lot of prairie flowers, a lot of things are going on underground that protects it from wind, weather, fire, and what have you. But genetically, they're really quite promiscuous. They can mix and match with other sunflower types. They speciate very quickly from the genus into separate species, which means that they're very adaptable. And this sort of free-flowing genetic swapping really makes it sort of the ultimate weed, if you will. So much so that if you, you know, you can actually, you know, follow trails of sunflowers when either buffalo or later humans disturbed the ground and brought seeds with them. They were one of the, you know, very, very capable of filling in those niches. And the genes, I mean, as time went on and human beings really started to modify them genetically found it very, very easy. I mean, even in prehistory, you find that the seed is growing larger and larger and larger. I mean, these were not Mendelian geneticists. They were just picking the sunflowers with the largest seeds.
Sure.
And that was enough to basically to domesticate them. And they've been proved themselves to be a great ally to human beings ever since then.
So how many different species do we know? And are they, you know, native and spread around the entire world? Or do we find them in certain places?
It's native to North America.
Okay.
They're not entirely sure where they're domesticated at first, but their original habitat is all through North America. Mm-hmm. and Mexico. And there are over 200 different species that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, as part of your perfect plant scenario you painted in your book, the ability of the sunflower to follow the sun, which most people see and don't understand, and then the incredible packaging of the seeds on the head, it's a perfect mathematical formula.
It's very interesting. Both of those traits make them sort of anthropomorphized and kind of spooky,
right.
Especially when you think of the sunflower head turning to follow the sun. That's called heliotropism, and it happens in very very young, you know, in juvenile sunflowers. And other flowers do it do that as well, but sunflowers really, with the yellow color and with that attribute, it really follows that they got that name. Even of deeper significance, possibly, is the spiral pattern of the seed spread, which it does mathematically conform to the Fibonacci sequence and thereby the golden ratio or pi.
Right.
The way that spiral, I mean, you find it in seashells, you find it in black holes, you find this number sequence where, you know, typically 55 seeds can twist in one way in the head and 34 in the other, which sort of is the best way to pack seeds, as many seeds as possible, into a plant head.
Most efficient. So let's talk about the thousands and thousands of years. I was telling Bob earlier, corn has always gotten sort of the prize of helping civilization move forward because of the art of cultivation. But it sounds like the sunflower should maybe take that prize after all. What's the evidence and how far back? And apparently, as you describe in the book, there's a bit of a controversy over who's had the sunflower the longest, at least in terms of domestication. But, you know, how long ago did people figure out the beauty and the value and the functionality of the sunflower?
I've traced the physical traits back to the early archaic period. That's 8,000 to 6,000 BC. And I mean, that's when the first evidence that sunflowers were consumed, and there's no denying that. But those were wild sunflowers, so people have been enjoying these things for as long as they've been around each other, almost. And what happened in the archaic period is that people were using the sunflower seeds, collecting them, reusing their campsites, and they would follow. Not only follow the herds, but they'd follow the edible plants and wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And when they would revisit and use the same caves, they would find that some of the seeds from the plants that they collected, some of the cast-offs were growing there. And here we have unnatural selection going on. They would pick up the seeds that had the biggest, loosest heads.
Sure.
And they started selecting for them. And when they were growing up close to the campsites, they tended to have the bigger heads, and you see the steady growth already.
Okay.
Unplanned going back then as well. So by 1000 BC, the entire continent was alive with small gardens. You fast forward many, many, many thousands of years, and you have, you know, Native Americans really cultivating these things, growing them between corn rows, once again select them even further for their oil content, as well as the seed size and how easy they can come out of the heads. So you have this fully domesticated plant. So the question becomes, well, who did it first? And you know, it seems like a little trivial piece of arcana, but for people who study this seriously, it's a very big deal. There's the concept of a hearth of agriculture plays into it, and if you have any number of what they call domesticates, which is the original wild plants being turned into a domesticated crop.
Mm-hmm.
They say that that North America is one hearth of agriculture. They have several kinds of domesticates, and then Mexico is another. corn being the main champion down there.
Mm-hmm.
The only crop that is that has survived in the modern day out of all the domesticates from North America is sunflowers. And if you take that away from them, then the case for calling North America a hearth of agriculture is greatly diminished. So mm-hmm. the stakes are at least academically a little bit higher.
So therein lies the controversy. Science suggesting that America had the first domesticated sunflower, where other scientists, you know, proposed that it was in southern Mexico.
That's exactly right, and the controversy still hasn't been put to bed. People take this very, very seriously. It's a very friendly plant with a very good reputation and connotations, but when you get these academics and scientists arguing over it, it's not pretty. they really had it out. So it's interesting in some of the backwaters that of academia that really hash out these minute details in human history.
Okay, you mentioned in your book, Sunflowers, The Secret History, I mentioned earlier the arc of the plant from the colonists used it, the Native Americans used it, went over to Europe, and then came back over here again. Talk some about that.
It really began with the first initial contact between Europeans and the reaction of these Europeans to some of the flora and the fauna, and sunflowers were high up on that list. They made it into a lot of woodcuts. They made it into a lot of the earliest books that doctors were putting together on the new plants, plants of the new world. It was all the rage. I mean, you can imagine if we discovered another planet and there was all these new life forms that people were eager to describe and see if there's any medicinal value and culinary value and everything else. And it really took off. Early explorers brought whole plants and seeds back with them, and they made their way into a lot of the earliest and some of the finest medical gardens in Europe. And from there, it was, you know, they tried to experiment with some foodstuffs, and the Jerusalem artichoke, which is now called the sunchoke most commonly, that was the root of a sunflower plant. So it got brought back over and trickled through Europe. It sort of went from a something that you'd put in your garden as a status symbol, and very, very quickly, oddly, even became something that the underclasses were using to snack on and to eat and to grow. Hundreds of years later, it's in Germany and starting to trickle into Russia, and that's really where the next stage of the story
everything
picks
changes.
Up.
Yeah.
Because the German peasants were making, and they still make, very delicious sunflower bread, and they were growing it in their backyard lots. And again, it's this hardy, easy to adapt plant had become a staple of diet of poor people. And when that happened in Russia, it was the big hallmark for the big turning point, I should say, in sunflower history. That turning point occurred when they started pressing it for oil.
Okay.
Peter the Great is credited for bringing the plant in and allowing and opening up the country enough so that new plants and new ways of thinking could be brought to the Russian people. And there's always a struggle, and I suppose that you could say it's still going on over, you know, the isolation of Russia and its modernization. And the sunflower played a big role in that. The Russian Orthodox Church, as a way of showing its strength, would pass these edicts, especially around religious times, or especially around Easter, and they passed these restrictive Lenten rules. And when fateful year, they decided to ban animal fats, and so you can't cook with any animal fats or oils.
Uh-huh.
And the peasantry responded they complied, but they responded
sure.
by using pressed sunflower
I think
seed
that's
oil
fabulous.
And to cook with. And
yeah.
what was once a very small niche peasant occupation all of a sudden became the way to cook, and that has stuck. And most importantly, it started the career of sunflowers as a cooking oil rather than as an ornamental plant or just something that you'd snack on or sort of put in the bread to flavor it. It changed the mankind's relationship with sunflowers forever, and mm-hmm. when it finally did come back in the pockets, literally, of Mennonites who came to seek refuge in Canada from Russia, they had sunflower seed presses, and they would press the oil out of it as soon as they got here. And once that took off in the United States, there was really no turning back. Huh. And then we start getting into some of the parts I enjoyed the most researching and finding out about was some of the Cold War back and forth between Russia and the United States, when they're literally fighting for the future of this flower.
Well, Joe, in an even larger historical context, two of the premises of your book, one of them is that the Irish potato famine never would have happened had they kept eating sunflower Jerusalem artichoke roots, mm-hmm. and that Hitler invaded Russia in part to get the sunflowers, which is monster history.
The idea that of why Hitler invaded the Soviet Union to begin with, when it was such a strategic and tactical error, they had a very happy relationship before then, carving up Poland and whatnot. Hitler very much wanted not only elbow room and breathing space out of the Soviet Union and despised the government there, but he also needed raw natural resources. And if you look at the history of Germany, especially leading up to the Nazi takeover of the country, famine is a very large, looming mark. It was psychologically damaging. The British had this embargo, and the French had an embargo that they didn't really lift at the end of World War One, and there was mass starvation and famine. And fighting that, not ever allowing that to happen, became part of the German psyche. And they sent in teams of industrial specialists to go and take over the sunflower manufacturing facilities in the occupied parts of the Soviet Union, just so they could get oil flowing back, sunflower oil flowing back into Germany. It'd be a very tangible sign that this invasion and this war was actually worthwhile.
And also, in this area of the country, I want to ask you about the Indiana University part in the sunflower research.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's the hotbed. I mean, you have two of the greatest minds, really, in sunflower research history, especially recent sunflower history. Mm-hmm. There's one man that really the entire industry is sort of indebted to. His name is Charles Heiser. He's in Bloomington, and he's an icon. And he started cataloging sunflowers in the very beginning of his career. His work is still sort of the cornerstone of a lot of research. He started working in 1942 in Missouri, and changed the entire field. He crafted the first monographs tracing the speciation of both the annual and perennial sunflowers, which was a mammoth undertaking, especially when to think of someone doing it in the late 1940s. Back then, only a few chromosome counts were even known. Scientists were just starting to use chromosomes and crossing plants to determine the relationships between hybrids and species. And he really tried to do it experimentally and then also comprehensively. So he was enormous.
So with the advancement in genetic technology, then we've also seen another face at the University of Indiana. But more current times, Lauren Reisberg?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what he's able to do, which I found absolutely fascinating, was you really make a genetic map of ancient hybrid sunflowers and determining which chromosome came from which parent. So you can see the genome and then look back in history, literally peer back and see how hybrids grew up and how they drove the evolution of sunflowers.
Joe, do you see the sunflower as one of the answers to our modern energy problems in terms of for ethanol or some kind of fuel base or food or what?
I would love to. They are a source for biofuel. That is beyond question that they've proven it. But there's certain attributes of the oil that doesn't make it so great for machinery. Basically, the real problem is size, because if you have an uncompressed gas tank and you would have the equivalent of gasoline or petrol or something, it would have to be, I think, on the around 3,000 times bigger, I believe. Also, the oils, it's very viscous, and with that much fuel and moving through a fuel injector, it's not that great. But as a blend, For biodiesel, it's not. It actually does hold some promise. So it's really, you know, it's another one of these. It's promising. We know we can do it, but the logistics, some of that really starts getting in the way, and
makes
you get
so
a good cold water dose of reality on that dream. But you can do it. You can do it.
Well, Joe, thanks. It's fascinating stuff, and we enjoy talking to you.
Well, hey, thank you guys so much. I definitely appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joe Pappalardo is a reporter and writer for Popular Mechanics and author of the book Sunflowers, The Secret History. For more information on sunflowers or the book, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Sunny, yesterday my life was filled with rain. And sunny, you smiled at me and really eased the pain. Now the dark days are bright and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you. Sunny, thank you for the sunshine bouquet. And sunny, my way, you gave to me your all in all, and now I feel 10 feet tall. Sunny one, so true. I love you.
Well, Miss Wishy, we're back with a trio of questions.
We are, and welcome back to Homegrown.
Indeed.
And here's one from Darlene.
Okay.
How can I get rid of chipmunks or at least keep them from digging holes and spreading the soil?
You say, hear chipmunk, and lead them into your traps. It's tough. I do use the user-friendly traps. What's the name for them? Have a heart traps for critters like that.
User-friendly, you mean trap
yeah,
friendly?
Like take them over to Shelby County and
let them go.
But, really, beyond that, it's kind of live and let live. I've just kind of adopted that philosophy with a lot of these ant critters. I've got so much space, they're not really a problem to me. But
yeah, I don't know how to get rid of them either, so have a heart trap is your best guess. Okay.
Here's one for you. Let me tell you this one.
Okay.
This is from Tanya. Do you know where I can buy beneficial nematodes for lawn grubs? I've not been able to find them in Louisville. Thanks for the help.
Mm-hmm. There is an organic gardening place out in J-Town called New Earth. They may have them. Otherwise, I do know for sure that Gardens Alive has them, you know, through mail order. I get a lot of organic products, in the past through them, but now it's easier to find them locally. But the beneficial nematodes, they'd actually be in the soil if we didn't disturb our soil so much. So that's why organic gardening actually is good. They're beneficial because they're part of that whole balance. They feed on the larvae of certain insects. You can get them for like cucumber beetle management. You can get them for grub management. You just have to sort of introduce them to the soil at the same time. But similarly, Bob, like, you know how people started buying like ladybugs?
Right.
And they'd release them in their garden thinking that was going to, well, ladybugs can go off to somebody else's place. Yeah. And if you don't keep that good balance, you're not going to continue to restore that healthy, you know, nematode balance. So you kind of have to keep up good practices.
And stay with it.
Stay with it. Exactly.
Last question. From Brian.
Okay.
I pulled many large weeds out of my lawn. Now there are small bald spots where the weeds are. I know the feeling. Will the grass expand to fill those spots on its own, or should I reseed? Most of these spots are in full sun.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I would reseed because, yeah, the grass would expand eventually, but before it has a chance to expand.
The weed seeds.
The weed seed will return.
They've not gone away.
Yeah.
They'll be dormant forever in there.
Yeah. So I would reseed and move on.
And add water.
And add water. There you go.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. Once again, Miss Wishy, you have lined up the perfect Latin word with our subject matter.
I'm trying to. The Latin word of the week this week is noctiflorus nocturnum. Or nocturnus, okay?
Yeah.
So noctiflorus, obviously night flowering, nocta florists, right? Yep. And then Nocturnum, sort of a little bit different, but suggests the same thing, that something's going to flower in the evening. So, for example, Sestrum Nocturnum.
The night flowering jasmine.
The night flowering jasmine. Yeah. And Peter had mentioned that and its association with ladies of the evening. I thought it was so interesting.
Well, I wouldn't know.
I wouldn't know about that either. Malandrium.
Okay.
You think? Noctiflorus, night blooming silene.
Yes.
I've got a regular blooming silene, I think. I'll have to check it at night and see what's
fun.
Going on, actually.
Wake out your nose.
Mm-hmm. Epidendron nocturnum.
The night scented orchid.
Night scented orchid, okay. And Ruellia noctiflora.
Speaking of wild ladies, it's a night flowering wild petunia.
Wild petunia. And I love wild petunias, actually, the Ruellia, but I do not believe that I have the night flowering variety.
That'd
so I'll have
good,
to seek that one out.
A good country song.
Yeah. Night flowering wild petunia.
Yeah, boy.
All right. Yeehaw. Well, noctiflorus nocturnum or nocturnus is going to suggest that, well, at least something's going on at night with the plant, so it's likely going to be its bloom.
Let's hope so.
Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, one of my favorite naturalists, actually, Bern Heinrich, up in Vermont. He's got a new book called Summer World.
Homegrown is produced by the always sunny Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.